reforms in immigration that have completely altered this country have not been the result of popular sentiment. They've been the result, really, of elite sentiment and frankly, you know, ethnic interest group lobbying and so on. Since 1924, when they lost that, Jews have had a huge animosity towards the culture that did that. Jews, as I said, have, because they see Western culture as fundamentally anti-Jewish, going back to the Middle Ages, they have wanted to essentially end European domination of this society. And I think they're well on the way to doing that. People who oppose immigration, they talk about, well, there are economic problems and this and that. Nolan simply says, Europeans are not going to benefit from this as a group, that we are giving up control of our country to other peoples. That there is a huge problem with this. That when you are a minority group, you better hope that the other groups in society are nice to you. Well, we Europeans should be concerned that our future will be as a minority group. And we will then be at the whim of coalitions that may have very hostile intent towards us. That we will lose control of our own future. That's the issue here. It's as simple as that. But even raising European ethnic interests is the big taboo of this period right now. We can't even raise the possibility that Europeans have ethnic interests. It's the taboo topic. And yet everybody else has ethnic interests, which are legitimate.
We lost the land of Israel, and as a result, we were thrown to the far corners of the world. We were persecuted. We had pogroms. We had terrible things, including the Holocaust.
I'm angry with some of the Jews. I'm very goddamn angry at some of the Jews. Hollywood is run by Jews. It's owned by Jews.
If I were a Jew, I'd be a Zionist. I am a Zionist. You don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist.
The task is to bring this minority together in such a way that it makes it impossible for the legacy of whiteness to continue to reproduce itself.
Often when there is dissent expressed in the United States against policies of the Israeli government, people here are called anti-Semitic. What is your response to that as an Israeli Jew?
Well, it's a trick. We always use it. When from Europe somebody is criticizing Israel, then we bring up the Holocaust. When in this country people are criticizing Israel, then they are anti-Semitic.
What is AZM? Talk about who AZM is and then place AZM for us in the Jewish world today.
How many hours do we have?
What else? No Jews? I think they said that earlier. But they told me I have to say it. If you see somebody kind of Jewy looking, then please tell an usher. And they will, sir, come on. Let's go. Come on.
We're looking forward to have, it says when Messiah will come, that the whole world will be a part of Jerusalem.
Guess who's at it again? Those Jews.
I am a Jew. I'm a Jew. Makes that guy in particular very upset.
If you want to know what's wrong with this world, it's the Jews. The Jews are the reason for all the evil in this world.
The only people nowadays can afford living help are rich people, Jews.
I hope the Jews did kill Christ. I'd do it again. I'd fucking do it again in a second.
Jews have played a disproportionate role in industries and endeavors that have harmed Western society and undermined Western civilization. And they have been disproportionately involved in pushing anti-Western narratives. They are vastly overrepresented in various media, including Hollywood, the press, and the porn industry. They are overrepresented in banking and campaign finance, and vastly overrepresented when it comes to pushing for mass immigration, They distort Western foreign policy by their constant lobbying for the West's involvement in wars in the Middle East and for hostility towards Russia. Now, when I say Jews, I clearly don't mean all Jews. Just like when people say Americans were involved in slavery. Well, less than 1.5% of Americans owned slaves at the height of the slave trade. Also, by saying Americans were involved in the slave trade, that doesn't mean only Americans were involved in the slave trade. So whilst Jews are disproportionately involved in anti-Western activity, that doesn't mean other groups aren't involved either. But there is another important component to all of this, and that's hypocrisy. Whilst Jews have pushed for pornography, mass immigration, open borders, miscegenation, and anti-family practices in the West, they have done the exact opposite in Israel. They have a walled ethno-state where they prevent mass immigration, where interfaith marriages are actually banned, and where they ban material like pornography that they themselves push in the West. You see, Jews have an extreme in-group preference, and there's nothing wrong with that. All peoples of the world have the right to in-group preference. But the issue here is that despite the extreme in-group preference that Jews have, many Jews actively work to undermine the in-group preference of others and have repeatedly been involved in practices that have a hugely negative impact on the culture, heritage, and traditions of those of European descent. Jews have attacked the glue that holds our society together with the aim of breaking up Western society. The problem here lies in the fact that Jews acknowledge the power and the strength that comes from community, family, and tradition. And whilst they want that power for themselves, too many of them seek to strip that power from us, those of European descent, in effect, placing themselves at an advantage and in a position where they, as a group, stand apart from all others as a cohesive ethnic bloc.
They may have some assumptions about Jews. They may have some prejudice about Jews, like the Jews run everything. Well, we do. The Jews run all the banks. Well, we do. The Jews run the media. Well, we do. You know, I mean, they're right about all that stuff. Now, what you do with that is the issue. But the reason they go on about...
I don't even know where to start with that, so just go.
We do. It's a fact. This is not in debate. It's a statistical fact. You know, Jews run most of the banks. Jews completely dominate the media. Vastly disproportionately represented in all of these professions. That's just a fact. It's not anti-Semitic to point out statistics.
In the ancient world, in the eastern part of the Fertile Crescent, also known as the Cradle of Civilization, is the Holy Land, the Land of Israel. And there, for centuries, the Jewish people flourished and lived in peace. And then, because they did not live up to their divine covenant, the Jews faced destruction after destruction at the hands of their enemies. First came the Babylonians, then the Persians, then the Greeks. And finally, with all their fury, the Romans, who forced them into exile and dispersion. For over 2,500 years, Jews suffered persecution.
And it really was a matter of reading the history, Jewish history, the history of anti-Semitism, and so on. These are the things that really woke me up. Jewish law does not have a sort of universalistic ethics. I mean, they have very different ethics for how you treat non-Jews versus Jews. And one of the things you can do with non-Jews is exploit them economically. This was a pattern throughout history. And then in the modern world, of course, it became different because Jews started to enter the mainstream of the West. The Western culture opened up, the Enlightenment, and Jews started to get into the mainstream. Jews started owning media, contributing to media, becoming intellectuals. For centuries, Jews were sort of relegated to their own ghettos. They didn't even associate with non-Jews. So they were out of the Western intellectual tradition. They didn't contribute to the science or the philosophy or anything. I mean, and because Jewish communities were completely insular and they did not allow any kind of contact with non-Jews. So Jews have always lived in proximity to each other. That's a very important aspect of diaspora Judaism. So they kept separate.
There is only one group of people across the Western world that you can't criticize. You can't criticize Jews. And I believe it was Voltaire who said, if you want to find out who rules over you, simply find out who you cannot criticize. And all over the world, there are special laws to defend Jews and Jewish interests. You cannot debate or question the Holocaust. You can be imprisoned. There are new laws being brought in the UK to specifically prevent discussion of Jewish power. There are these special laws that will make it illegal to actually criticize the state of Israel here in the UK, because that will be branded as anti-Semitic. Jews have been thrown out of 359 different countries, nations, or states. That tells you something. Is the whole world anti-Semitic? Is the whole world anti-Jewish? Or are these people organizing in different countries all over the world in a way that is not conducive to the well-being of the indigenous people of those nations? I'll let the audience make up their minds themselves.
Israel was created on May 14, 1948, when a UN resolution set aside land as an official Jewish state in what was formerly the British-controlled region of Palestine.
After 2,000 years, a Jewish nation once again exists. And while there is a rattle of gunfire in the Holy Land, there is cheering in Washington and Hebrew dances of joy for a Jewish homeland that has been reborn.
For the Jews, their new nation was more than just a refuge after the end of World War II and the Holocaust. It was a return to the homeland that they believed had originally been theirs some 4,000 years ago.
For the last several thousand years, all we've been trying to do is come back to our ancient homeland and rebuild our sovereign life as an independent, sovereign Jewish state, living in peace with its neighbors. This is what we've sought. This is what this whole country is about. It's the rebirth. It's the great rebirth of the Jewish people.
One of the biggest myths about the Israel-Palestine conflict is that it's been going on for centuries. Conflict's mostly about two groups of people who claim the same land. And it really only goes back about a century to the early 1900s. After World War I, the Ottoman Empire collapsed, and British and French empires carved up the Middle East, the British taking control of a region it called the British Mandate for Palestine. At first, the British allowed Jewish immigration. But as more Jews arrived, settling into farming communities, tension between Jews and Arabs grew. Both sides committed acts of violence, and by the 1930s, the British began limiting Jewish immigration. In response, Jewish militias formed to fight both the local Arabs and to resist British rule. Then came the Holocaust, leading many more Jews to flee Europe for British Palestine and galvanizing much of the world in support of a Jewish state. In 1947, as sectarian violence between Jews and Arabs there grew, the United Nations approved a plan to divide British Palestine into two separate states. One for Jews, Israel, and one for Arabs, Palestine. The city of Jerusalem, where Jews, Muslims, and Christians all have holy sites, was to become a special international zone.
Of all the countries that have come into existence in the last century, no country's birth certificate is more legitimate than that of Israel. One reason is that many of the men who founded the country, Theodor Herzl, Zeb Jabotinsky, David Ben-Gurion, Menachem Begin, Yitzhak Shamir, were either lawyers or had legal training. They were obsessed with making it legal. Unlike almost every other country, lawyers, not generals, were the midwives of Israel's birth, or more accurately, rebirth, since it had existed as an independent country twice before in history. Yet immediately upon its lawful establishment in 1948 as the nation-state of the Jewish people, Israel was illegally attacked by all the surrounding Arab states, as well as by elements of the local Arab population. The end result of that war against Israel was an armistice line that prevailed until 1967, when Israel was once again attacked by Jordan, during Israel's war with Egypt and Syria. How can this worldwide attack on Israel alone be explained? In only one way. It is pure anti-Semitism. If you have a better explanation for why the one country in the world whose right to exist is denied is also the one country that is the nation state of the Jewish people, I ask you, what is it?
First off, anti-Semitism, what does that mean? What is a Semite? A Semite is a member of any of the peoples who speak or spoke a Semitic language. Let me say that again. A Semite is a member of any of the peoples who speak or spoke a Semitic language, including, in particular, the Jews and Arabs.
Anti-Semitism has never gone away. It just has, and I could see if you're an anti-Semite, you're going, the evil of the Jews is the closest I come to believing in magic because they just never stop being evil. Like, I just don't understand how this never goes away. It never goes away. It's so fucking weird. Like, no matter where Jews have lived, no matter how assimilated they've been, it follows the Jews. And I mean, I know that I'm sure at least one of your listeners is like, no, the Jews follow it. But it's like, it's crazy. It just won't go away. It's a virus that won't ever die down.
Well, the ADL created a questionnaire of 11 anti-Semitic statements or stereotypes, including Jews have too much power in international financial markets. Jews have too much control over the global media. Jews still talk too much about what happened to them in the Holocaust. And people hate Jews because of the way Jews behave. Those who said at least 6 statements are probably true are considered by the ADL to harbor anti-Semitic attitudes. The ADL's index attempts to leave people's political views on Israeli politics out of its equation. Of the people globally who believe a majority of the anti-Semitic stereotypes are probably true, the vast majority have never met a Jewish person.
Some of history's most influential thinkers and writers, Voltaire, Dostoevsky, T.S. Eliot, many, many others, spread the most preposterous lies about the Jewish people. It's hard to shed prejudices that have been ingrained in consciousness over millennia. And from antiquity to the Middle Ages to modern times, Jews were boycotted, discriminated against, and singled out. Today, the singling out of the Jewish people has turned into the singling out of the Jewish state.
Better side of Hollywood?
Yep.
There is no better side of Hollywood. You have to be Jewish to be in Hollywood.
You mean as a producer?
At any level, yeah. Any level.
So you see that there is a racial discrimination in Hollywood?
Oh, yes, all the time. As an Indian producer, you know, you can make a movie, but then again, who's going to buy it? The Hollywood big studios, you know, all controlled by Jews. They don't want to let others get in, you know.
You really can't stress too much how pervasively Jewish the movie industry was in New York before World War I. Not that Jews were making movies or acting in movies, but there probably would not have been an extended Jewish family in New York at that time who did not have some relatives involved in some aspect of the movie industry, which was really a mom-and-pop industry of storefront theaters in not very elegant neighborhoods.
Modern America first saw light on a Hollywood screen. It was largely the product of 6 movie studios established in the 1920s and run for over 30 years by a group of Jewish immigrants. They had strikingly similar backgrounds.
All races and religions, that's a man.
Harry Warner, who with 3 of his brothers brought sound to the motion picture, was born in Poland.
I was Jack Warner, youngest of the Warner clan, and then the senior member of the film-famed brothers.
Also from Poland was Samuel Goldwyn, born Goldfish. Although Goldwyn never ran a major studio, he was perhaps the biggest and best known of the independent Hollywood producers. Universal founder Carl Laemmle came from a small town in Germany. Louis B. Mayer, who gave us the glory years of the MGM studio, was born in a Russian Jewish village. William Fox and Paramount's Adolf Zucker were both born in Hungary. Fox's studio merged with 20th Century Pictures to form 20th Century Fox. The Hollywood Jews were obsessed with erasing anything Jewish in their films, their lives, and the lives of their stars. Theodosia Goodman became Theda Barrow. Sophia Kosso became Sylvia Sidney. Isser Danielovich Dembski became Kirk Douglas. Leo Jacoby became Lee J. Cobb. Shirley Shrift became Shelley Winters. Bernard Schwartz became Tony Curtis. David Kaminsky became Danny Kaye. Edward Iskovitz became Eddie Cantor. Melvin Hesselberg became Melvin Douglas. Muni Wiesenfreund, a star of the Yiddish theater, became Paul Muni. Emmanuel Goldenberg became Edward G. Robinson. The G was a reminder of who he really was. Nice Jewish girls, such as Lily Palmer, Julie Holliday, and Lauren Bacall, or Betty Persky, helped to define the American woman.
But ultimately, this shadow America becomes so popular and so widely disseminated that its images and its values come to devour the real America. And so the grand irony of all of Hollywood is that Americans come to define themselves by the shadow America that was created by Eastern European Jewish immigrants who weren't admitted to the precincts of the real America.
You want me to fight? I can't fight. How can I fight? What Jewish guy do you know fights? How can I do it? It's impossible. When's the last time you heard a Goldberg fight a Perez? Never happened. Never. You pay someone to fight, but you don't fight. It costs too much money if you get hurt. You understand me?
The vast majority of Jews, 2 million out of 2.5 million, who left Eastern Europe to find their dream, went to America. The smart money was on America. It was the simple place where you could imagine the dream of Jews having both opportunity for tolerance and also economic security. The dream with which the Jews came to America was very quickly frustrated. They couldn't get into financial services. They could work for slave wages. They couldn't live in the good neighborhoods. They could live in tenement slums. And it didn't take long before a great number of them began to once again fantasize about what it would really mean to realize the original dream.
The first moguls tended to come from various aspects of the sales business. Dry goods sales, Lemley was a clothier, Goldwyn was a glove salesman, Adolf Zukor in furs, Louis Selznick in the diamond business. And as they approached the motion picture industry, they approached it not from an engineering point of view, not from technology or machinery, but from how they can distribute a product.
To make a list of the lines of business controlled by the Jews of the United States would be to touch most of the vital industries of the country. The theatrical business, of course, as everyone knows, is exclusively Jewish. Play producing, booking, theater operation are all in the hands of Jews. This perhaps accounts for the fact that in almost every production today can be detected propaganda, sometimes glaringly commercial advertisement, which does not originate with playwrights but with producers. The motion picture industry, the sugar industry, the tobacco industry, 50% or more of the meatpacking industry, upward of 60% of the shoemaking industry, men's and women's ready-made clothing, most of the musical purveying done in the country, jewelry, grain, more recently, cotton, the Colorado smelting industry, magazine authorship, news distribution, the liquor business, the loan business. These, only to name the industries with national and international sweep, are in control of the Jews of the United States, either alone or in association with Jews overseas.
Thomas Sowell has a theory, and he basically says that people who are middlemen in any civilization are the people who are going to rise to the top because they're not benefiting from the home ground of being natives, and they're doing all the transactional work. And so that means that they have their own sort of in-group where they can negotiate with one another, so they'd say, like, Hasidic diamond merchants, for example. They don't need contracts, so they can cut out the middleman, and so they can keep costs low, and they can do well that way. But also, because they don't have that ground, they have to. They're forced to use the system as best they can, which usually means playing by the rules of the system in the most efficient possible way.
Yeah. I'm here to tell a story about the tremendous contributions that were made by the Jewish mob for the betterment of the welfare of the Jewish people during from the 20th century going forward. So we begin in the ghettos of every major city of the United States. These kids were tough kids. a struggle to survive, to take care of your parents. Well, we all know that 1920 was the passing of the Volstead, the Prohibition, and this was a tremendous opportunity for immigrants. So they eventually took over all of alcohol to the point where Abner Longy's woman became known as the Al Capone of New Jersey.
You wouldn't know it from the Jewish Hollywood movies, but Jews have dominated organized crime all over Europe for hundreds of years before there was any Sicilian mafia at all. 99% of you watching this video have no idea that Jews, not Italians, led the most powerful and murderous crime syndicates. The fountainhead of organized crime in America for the entire 20th century was Murder Incorporated. It was an overwhelmingly Jewish organization, the fountainhead for organized crime in America for the rest of the 20th century. Murder Incorporated wasn't Italian and it wasn't a mafia. It was as Jewish as gefilte fish and matzo balls. From this single organization came the biggest organized crime bosses in American history. The most powerful organized crime figure in America was not Al Capone, it was Meyer Lansky, one of the original leaders of Murder Incorporated. Law enforcement personnel agree on the power of Lansky. And they also agree that Lansky was a big Zionist. This is how Newsweek put it. Each year, Lansky and his underworld associates pour vast sums into Israeli bonds and Israeli philanthropies. As the Daily Haaretz saw it, the government seemed afraid of losing the millions of dollars in illicit money first laundered in mob-controlled institutions and then funneled into Israeli businesses and industry. And this was also the most ruthless, murderous, evil crime organization ever to exist in the United States. They killed hundreds of people, from fellow criminals to many innocent individuals. Their specialty was to kill people slowly with ice picks or by hog-tying people in such a way as when they struggled to breathe, they would slowly strangle themselves. Nice, huh? The organization was overwhelmingly Jewish, much like the leadership of the early murderous Bolsheviks in Russia, another fact you're not allowed to know. Here is just a partial list of their members with some colorful nicknames for these bloody killers. Max the Jerk Golob, Louis Lepke, Lou Colbert, Abadaba Berman, Frankie Tietelbaum, Lulu Rosencrantz, Lou Cohen, Mickey Cohen, Tootsie Feinstein, Izzy Farbstein, Pittsburgh Phil Strauss, Bugsy Goldstein, Bugsy Siegel, Gangy Cohen, Tick-Tock Tannenbaum, Arnold Rothstein, Meyer Lansky, Big Greeny Greenbaum, Sholem Bernstein, and I could go on and on and on. By the way, they sound like the names of the bosses of the Federal Reserve, International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. Meanwhile, Jewish Hollywood studios have churned out movie after movie about the Italian mafia and very little about the Jewish syndicate. Now, many of you listening to me at this minute have deeply ingrained associations of organized crime with Italians, Italian names, Italian music and food. The trick is that Jewish crime bosses had allies that Italians didn't. They had allies in the Hollywood film industry, allies in the biggest elements of the news media, and many allies in government who were beholden to Jewish money and political influence.
But he who parted the sea is a part of me, and when I look in my heart, I see the same mystery, and I know that we share the same history. Yeah, Hebrew is the language of G-D, so silently I know he walks with me like an OG. I'm G'd up, I'm G-D'd up, I'm a read up with my feet up. Sabbath is just practice till we all get freed up, so please plant your seeds up. Israel's the bride and the groom's inside, and when I'm staring at the line, I'm like open wide, and when I'm drowning in the ocean, I will
choke the tide, snatch a patch from the sky, put that patch in my eye. You can tell me I'm fly, but it's not for a white guy. Back when I rapped in high school, people told me that I'm tight for a white dude.
What'd you tell?
I'm not white, I'm Jewish. I'm not white, I'm Jewish. Back when I rapped in high school, people told me that I'm tight for a white dude.
What'd you tell?
I'm not white, I'm Jewish. I'm not white, I'm Jewish. With my eyes, know my shine, show wise guys' eyes, close respect and what my mind, know my reaches like a newborn's, I'm grabbing at everything, get mad rich and take it back from the savages, Sabbath is past, but it's not ash to ash, no it's what to what, and it's task to task, yeah, life is to act with more secrets than a key to new, it doesn't matter what you think, it only matters what you do, tired these days, getting up earlier, my eyes carry baggage, my Jew froze curlier, the patch on my pants for the lack of the cabbage is a problem, I'm working and I'm solving, we all in.
I rapped in high school, people told me that I'm tight for a white dude.
I'm not white, I'm Jewish. I'm not white, I'm Jewish.
When
I rapped in high school, people told me that I'm tight for a white dude. I'm not white, I'm Jewish. I'm not white, I'm Jewish. These years, introspection, learning text and reflection. If what's inside has died, you better believe in resurrection. Give me protection from the godless. Let my conscience place its candle on the mantle to illuminate the nonsense. I'm well equipped with legitimateness when I spit, so it's a bit ridiculous to just talk. It was God sick when he blew his breath in the chest of his convict. Trapped in paradise, my para eyes are paralyzed.
In high school, people told me that I'm tight for a white dude.
I'm not white, I'm Jewish. I'm not white, I'm Jewish.
Back when I rapped in high school, people told me that I'm tight for a white dude.
I'm not white, I'm Jewish. I'm not white, I'm Jewish. Prophet, but he who parted the sea is a part of me, and when I look in my heart, I see the same mystery, and I know that we share the same history, yeah, Hebrew is the language of G-D, so silently I know he walks with me like an OG, I'm G'd up, I'm G-D'd up, I'm a read up with my feet up, Sabbath is just practice till we all get freed up, so please plant your seeds up, Israel's the bride and the groom's inside, and when I'm staring at the line, I'm like open wide, and when I'm drowning in the ocean, I will choke the tide. Snatch a patch from the sky, put that patch in my eye. You can tell me I'm fly, but it's not for a white guy.
Back when I rapped in high school, people told me that I'm tight for a white dude.
I'm not white, I'm Jewish.
I'm not white, I'm Jewish.
Back when I rapped in high school, people told me that I'm tight for a white dude.
I'm
not white, I'm Jewish.
I'm not white, I'm Jewish.
Even with my eyes, know my shine, show wise guys' eyes, close respect and what my mind, know my reaches like a newborn's, I'm grabbing at everything, get mad rich and take it back from the savages, Sabbath is past, but it's not ash to ash, no it's what to what, and it's task to task, yeah, life is to act with more secrets than a key to new, it doesn't matter what you think, it only matters what you do, I'm tired these days, getting up earlier, my eyes carry baggage, my Jew froze curlier, the patch on my pants for the lack of the cabbage is a problem, I'm working on solving, we all
in. I rapped in high school, people told me that I'm tight for a white dude.
I'm not white, I'm Jewish.
I'm not white, I'm Jewish.
When I rapped in high school, people told me that I'm tight for a white dude.
I'm
not white, I'm Jewish.
I'm not white, I'm Jewish.
These years, introspection, learning text and reflection. If what's inside has died, you better believe in resurrection. Give me protection from the godless. Let my conscience place its candle on the mantle to illuminate the nonsense. I'm well equipped with legitimateness when I spit, so it's a bit ridiculous to just talk. It was God sick when he blew his breath in the chest of his convict. Trapped in paradise, my para eyes are paralyzed.
In high school, people told
me that I'm tight for a white dude.
For a white dude.
I'm not white, I'm Jewish. I'm not white, I'm Jewish. Back when I rapped in high school, people told me that I'm tight for a white dude. I'm not white, I'm Jewish. I'm not white, I'm Jewish.
Let us hope and pray that I'm worthy of being a descendant of the prophets.
So how many people in Europe would be eligible under the law of return to move here?
3 million, 4 million maybe altogether. It could change the geopolitics.
What do you mean that it could change the geopolitics?
You know, it's the demography is the key of everything, as you know. Between the Jordan and the Mediterranean, this is the borders, 10 million people. About 500,000 Jews and 500,000 Arabs. And if we want to remain a democratic state, we have to have a majority of Jews in this place. Already we have the birth rate among Arabs is decreasing and the birth rate among Jews is increasing. So it's already a change. The train of history is on its way.
I think there's a resurgence of anti-Semitism because at this point in time, Europe has not yet learned how to be multicultural. And I think we're going to be part of the throes of that transformation, which must take place. Europe is not going to be the monolithic societies that they once were in the last century. Jews are going to be at the center of that. It's a huge transformation for Europe to make. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive.
Waiting to help them on the beaches of Greece are the last people the Syrians might expect. Volunteers from Israel.
My name is Tali Shaltiel. I'm here with Israel, an Israeli-based NGO.
My name is Majida Kardosh. I'm here as a medical team. I work as a nurse.
My name is Iris Adler. I live in Tel Aviv. I just finished med school in Tel Aviv University.
We brought a team from Israel, which is Arab speaking.
And we are saying, yes, we will love our neighbor. Last week, Hias organized a letter signed by over 1,200 rabbis. Can you imagine getting 1,200 rabbis to agree on one thing? But agree they did. And what they agreed was to ask our elected officials not to halt or even to limit the United States Refugee Admissions Program. And it's not just Hayats. Jewish organizations of all kinds across the spectrum of Judaism are issuing statements in support of refugees. These have included the Orthodox Union, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, and so many of the Jewish organizations that you heard are co-sponsors of this event this evening.
What's right now at the top of the agenda for you from within the JCPA?
There are two issues at the top of our agenda at the very moment. One is the unbelievably important immigration debate in this country, to make sure that immigrants from around the world, particularly those from south of our border, have a chance here. The 12 million that, or 13 million that just live here and do work and aren't really going home, that they have a chance to stay here justly and with as legal immigrants. And that debate is so important because we know what it's like to come to another country, even one called the United States of America, where we weren't always so welcome.
AJC has always worked on the premise that as a minority, our security, our strength, our well-being in America is interdependent with those of other minorities. This is a Jewish issue. It is a Jewish issue to care about those around us, to care about the larger society. It is very much a Jewish issue. We do not.
But when you're importing 60 million people, you can't undo that very well. That's setting up a massive ethnic conflict. And that is radically opposed to the interests of the white majority.
The middle class would gladly pay taxes if they knew it was going to help poor people, not to murder people in foreign countries. I'm sick and tired of our money being used to advance the interests of the United States and Israel I stand here as the only person who has the courage to speak out for our people, and I'm going to do it loudly and clearly tonight. Now, we're just Israel and the United States, I don't know, can I say bitch on TV? I don't know, but that's what we are. We do whatever they tell us, and we're murdering these people, and then we're told to bring them over here. It's wrong, absolutely wrong.
See, Jews in space!
Jews are in space, presuming alone, protecting the Hebrew race. If Jews are in space, if trouble appears, we'll put it right back in its place. When Goyim attack us, we'll give them a smack, we'll stab them right back in the face.
I've never asked myself, who am I? Jews don't do this. They know who they are, especially when confronted with a challenge to their identity. How do Jews think? Basically, everything is filtered through the lens of us and them. Especially when Goyish culture throws one's Yiddishkeit into stark relief.
How does the Torah view non-Jews? Does the Torah view non-Jews as inferior to Jews?
Well, we are the chosen people. We are racist, meaning that we know God chose us to be his people, because since we're the chosen people, that's why we suffer pogroms and inquisitions and holocausts, because we're God's people, and God takes us to task for not acting like we should up to his standards, and therefore we have to go through things that are very difficult. We consider ourselves the chosen people, we're God's people, and it comes along with a lot of responsibility. But we want to be Jews, we're happy we're Jews, and even though we have to live up to expectations of God, we're very happy to be Jewish, and we wouldn't give it up for anything.
אנחנו גזענים כדי לרצות לשמור על החיים שלנו ועל השפיות שלנו. אז אני גאה בלהיות גזענית. אני גאה בלהיות גזענית. אם אני גזענית בשביל לשמור על החיים שלי, אז אני גאה.
From my experience, I can say that the chances for a healthy relationship between an Israeli Jewish woman and an Arab man are very, very low. It's because of the great differences between these two cultures.
איפה פגשת ילד ערבי? ליד הכותל.
ודיברת איתו?
לא, הוא דחף אותי, אבל לא...
ומה קורה כשאתם רואים ילד ערבי? מה אתם מרגישים?
יש עוד זעם.
זעם?
אהה.
מה קורה כשאתם פוגשים ילד חילוני?
למה אתה מרחם
עליו? שלא אומרת חרדי, מה הוא מפסיד?
הוא לא הולך לדעת
כאן כל עמי. כשאתם חושבים על ירושלים בעוד 10 שנים?
כולם חרדים.
כולם חרדים?
לא כולם חרדים.
האם אתה מאמין שהגויים יהיו עבדים של היהודים יום אחד?
כן, זה כתוב בתורה.
אוקיי, ומה זה אומר?
כל מה שכתוב בתורה אני מאמין.
כן? ומה כתוב? כתוב בפירוש שהגויים יהיו עבדים שלנו?
כן, כתוב שאחרי ביאת המשיח, אני לא יכול, אני אומר, כתוב אחרי ביאת המשיח, אני לא יכול להביא את הפסוק המדויק, אבל כתוב שאחרי ביאת המשיח יהיה מלחמה מאוד מאוד גדולה, ובסופו של דבר כן, הגויים יהיו עבדים של היהודים במשך תקופה, ואחרי זה העולם יחזור כאילו לקדמותו. זה מה שאני...
הם חיות,
הם קויים בהמות, כתוב.
כתוב, אתם קויים עוד אום ואין הם קויים עוד.
זהו, אבל לא הם בהמות.
אה, נכון, לא כתוב שהם
בהמות. אבל יש איזה הסבר על זה, נכון, למה הם...
אז מי, כן, מה כתוב? זה מה שאני לא מבין.
כתוב שאתם קויים אדם, והגויים לא קרויים אדם, זה מה שכתוב.
לא קרויים?
לא קרויים אדם, לא קוראים להם אדם.
אוקיי, אז מה קוראים להם?
אדם זה אדמה לעליונים.
אדם הוא בן אדם שהוא שונה מהבהמה. אם הבן אדם עושה את מעשה הבהמה, אז הוא כמו הבהמה, מה זה שווה? כל בן אדם צריך לשלוט על עצמו.
אוקיי.
זה היהודים שולטים על עצמם.
אוקיי.
אם היצר אומר להם לעשות דבר והם לא עושים, אז זה בן אדם.
אוקיי, אבל רגע, מה שאני לא מבין, זה כל הגויים הם, איך רואים?
תקשיב שנייה, אדוני.
בהמות.
אני יכול להגיד לך משהו?
אם יש להם, אם אין להם ציווי.
אדם, שנייה, אדם זה על שם אדמה לעליון. אדם זה כביכול אדמה לאלוקים. אוקיי? זה פירוש אדם. אנחנו הפכנו את זה, זאת אומרת, העם הפך את זה. ואדם, בן אדם, כמובן, אתה בן אדם, אתה צריך להתנהג כמו בן אדם. אבל בעיקרון זה על שם עליון. אדם זה אדמה לעליון, וכיוון שאנחנו בנים של אלוקים, אז הוא קרא לנו בן אדם. עכשיו, הגויים מה שהם, כן? אלוקים עשה אותם בשביל שיעשו פה...
בשביל לשרת את היהודים. כל הגויים שאתה רואה שיש בעולם, המיליארדים האלה, הם הכל רק בשביל שהיהודים יהיה להם איזה תועלת. כל אחד יהיה לו, כשמשיח יבוא, אז כל אחד יהיה לו...
יהיה לו
אלפים עבדים. 2,800 עבדים.
בינתיים, המשיח לא כאן, אז איך הם משרתים אותנו?
הם בונים לנו רכבים?
בסדר, לא יודעים.
דירות, בניינים?
הם עושים הכל.
למי הם בונים את זה? לנו. משרתים את זה.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Yes. The Holocaust is big business because Germany so far has given the Jews, I think, at least $200 billion. So it's big business. And some of you are still getting $1,000 a month. And a lot of people don't know this. And then people don't realize who brought the slaves to America. They were Jewish ships.
Who were the owners of these slave ships? Who were the biggest slavers in the 16th century? The Ashkenazi were the biggest slavers in the 16th and 17th century. There's a ton of sources out there, but I'll stick with the Jewish ones because that's just safer. Jewish merchants routinely possessed enormous numbers of slaves temporarily before selling them off. If a slave auction fell on a Jewish festival, it was postponed due to lack of buyers and sellers. Rabbi Herbert Bloom adds that the slave trade was one of the most important Jewish activities.
The cotton plantations in many parts of the South were wholly in the hands of the Jews, and as a consequence, slavery found its advocates among them.
The most egregious, cruel, and murderous aspect of this period was the transatlantic slave trade, often called the Middle Passage. Scholarly studies of the loss of life during the transportation of slaves to the Americas suggest that between 7 and 10 million Africans suffered indescribable cruelty and perished in the Middle Passage. The human suffering and death from the African slave trade is the cornerstone of white guilt, both in America and around the world, and has been tirelessly promoted by both academic and popular media. It quoted prominent Jewish historians who claim that the African slave trade, and indeed slavery in the West, for the last 2,000 years, was thoroughly dominated by the Jewish community. Here are some words of the major Jewish history of the early Americas called New World Jewry. It's by S.B. Liebman and the American Jewish Historical Society. He wrote about those who owned and manned the ships, the perpetrators of this mass human cruelty and murder. Quote, they came with ships carrying African blacks to be sold as slaves. The traffic in slaves was a royal monopoly, and the Jews were often appointed as agents for the crown in their sale. They, the Jews, were the largest ship chandlers in the entire Caribbean region, where the shipping business was mainly a Jewish enterprise. The ships were not only owned by Jews, but were manned by Jewish crews and sailed under the command of Jewish captains.
Jews have always had an extraordinarily high focus on education. So the literacy rate in the Jewish community back in ancient times is nearly 100% for men and women. So Jews have always been very into study, which is why we have giant sets of Talmud that sit on our shelves.
I was recently asked to explain what's the difference between Torah and Talmud. We Jews believe that when Moses went on Mount Sinai, he really received two Torahs, so to speak. One is the written Torah that we know as the Chumash, or the five books of Moses. And the other was an oral Torah, or explanations of those five books and all the rules and regulations and understandings of Jewish life. There are many things in the Torah which are left unclear, and we have many, many commentaries, that we study with, which would help us to be able to understand what the text says. But we also have a tradition of oral interpretation and understanding that goes all the way back to Moses and is passed on from teacher to teacher to teacher to teacher, all the way down to us. And ultimately, the ultimate production of the oral law was the Talmud, a huge, huge collection of the lectures and discussions of rabbis over a period of about 400 years. There's lots and lots and lots of things in the Talmud. Now, you'll hear sometimes about crazy things in the Talmud. Well, the fact is, the Talmud is trying to explore points of law. Nevertheless, the scholars have to follow very defined rules and protocols for interpreting the text. And when we look at the rabbis of the Talmud, we're not just looking at any rabbis. We're looking at people who are deeply, deeply steeped in the Torah and whose knowledge of Torah is really unsurpassed. And so what we're looking at is the oral Torah delivered all the way from Mount Sinai, interpreting the written Torah. So it's Torah interpreting Torah, right? Not rabbis interpreting Torah.
In Babylon, the Pharisees codified their oral traditions into the Babylonian Talmud, the written form of that oral tradition which Jesus so bitterly rebuked.
Jesus described the Pharisees as hypocrites, children of hell, blind guides, whited sepulchres, full of dead men's bones. He even described the Pharisees as children of their father the devil, a murderer from the beginning.
And what we're saying is we've read the book. We know what the book says. The book calls for killing innocent children. There's no fine distinctions made here. It's a book of racist statements in the name of the Torah.
The Talmud provides generous loopholes for adultery. It says the penalty for adultery does not include sex with a minor, the wife of a minor, or the wife of a heathen. In Babylon, sexual perversion of every kind had been a way of life for millenniums. The Pharisees were deeply influenced by such practices.
So the Shekhinah refers to the divine presence.
And it's a feminine word, by the way. Mm-hmm. It's not masculine.
You see, this so-called divine presence at the Wailing Wall is actually the Kabbalistic feminine emanation of their false god, the Shekhinah. Watch closely how the rabbis thrust their pelvises and penises back and forth in a prescribed prayer movement called davening, in which the Jew copulates with the Shekhinah in order to give birth to an erotic union with the Ein Sof, the Kabbalistic masculine emanation of their false god. Now watch this young Jewish boy who, instinctively knowing that davening is a lewd and embarrassing act, just can't bring himself to perform the thrusting of his pelvis.
In three of the major treatises of the Talmud, are found extensive passages which give legal endorsement to seduce and marry three-year-old baby girls.
When a grown-up man has intercourse with a little girl, it is nothing. Or when the girl is less than this, 3 years and a day, it is as if one put the finger into the eye. As tears come to the eye again and again, so does virginity come back to the little girl under 3 years. The intercourse of a small boy is not regarded as a sexual act.
When they circumcise little boys, the rabbi actually puts his mouth around the penis and sucks the blood. I am not making this up. This is Talmudic Damn. Judaism, and this is what is being carried out in Israel. So for those who want to support Israel, especially the idiot Christian Zionists, my God, how stupid are you? These people hate Jesus Christ, and they definitely are using you like a bunch of idiot pawns for their own sick and twisted game.
The quickest way to grasp the Talmudic view of Gentiles is not directly from the Talmud, but from the Jewish encyclopedias. What the Jewish encyclopedia provides us is a definitive overview of perhaps hundreds of rabbinic statements on any subject, giving us accurate summaries of what the Talmud generally teaches.
Gentiles they class not as men, but as barbarians. Since Gentiles are not men in the fullest sense, so the Gentile is not a neighbor of a Jew. The Gentile was forever beneath the Jew. Gentiles were outlawed by God from the beginning and thus had no property rights. Since the Talmud outlawed the child or issue of a Gentile as that of a beast, A Gentile had as little legal rights in a Jewish court as did an animal. So vile was the nature of a Gentile that the great Simeon ben Yohai said, "The best among the Gentiles deserves to be killed. The best of snakes ought to have its head crushed." Jews, however, are exalted beings in the Talmud, worthy of praise. Because the Talmud conspires against Gentiles, if a Jew was ever caught telling a Gentile what the Talmud really says, such a person deserves death.
And my father liked to sabotage anything that I did. So, like, if he heard me writing, if he heard me typing, he would always break in on me and try to mess up my concentration. And so while I'm reading this, he walked in without knocking. He threw open the door, and he caught me reading the Gospel according to St. Luke. Now, you have to think about this for a minute, right? I'm 15 years old. He could have walked in on me with a girl in the bed. I was doing that. But he walked in on me reading the Gospel according to St. Luke, and he was furious. I mean, the rage came out of him in little bits because he was trying not to let it out, but it kept bubbling up out of him like hot tar, and he couldn't stop it. He was cursing at me. He was using, you know, foul language, and he would keep bursting out. And we went in to have dinner, and we'd sit down, and it kept coming out.
Of course, we have Hebrew Christians this very day. The question is, why can't I be a religious Jew, believe in the Torah, and still say that Jesus is the Messiah?
Exactly.
Classical Jewish literature does not accept the notion of a second coming, and that is, once the Messiah reveals himself, he will accomplish a designated mission of getting the Jews back to Israel, rebuilding the temple, and hopefully establishing world peace. Now, Jesus, of course, was crucified. Jesus was murdered before he completed any of those things. And because of that, Christianity developed the idea of a second coming, that Jesus will come back and complete the mission. As I say, as far as normative Jewish theology is concerned, when the Messiah comes, he's going to get the job done, and he's not going to die and then come back.
There is a special antagonism between the Talmud and Jesus. The Talmud attacks him everywhere it can, even his mother. Mary, the Talmud says, was a whore who mated with carpenters. She, who was the descendant of princes and governors, played the harlot with carpenters. Jesus, according to this article, was considered one of the three worst enemies of Judaism, who came to an ignoble end. The Talmud says they subjected him to four deaths: stoning, burning, decapitation, and strangling. The Talmud also says he is now in hell, punished with boiling hot excrement. Christians, as followers of the false prophet Jesus, also deserve death. The Jewish Encyclopedia again recaps the Talmud's position. A Gentile observing the Sabbath deserves death.
שלום, הגעתם לתוכנית ההיסטוריה של טופי והגורילה. היום נלמד על צליבת ישו. שמעת על ישו?
הוא נשמע אדם נחמד.
לא, ישו היה אויב העם היהודי.
Note, Jesus is, quote, an enemy of the Jewish people.
אני רוצה להתבולל.
אתה יודע בכלל מה זה להתבולל? זה לקיים יחסי מין עם גויה. זה לא דבר שלא אני ולא אתה רוצים, כמובן.
Assimilation is, quote, to get effed up with a goya. And by the way, that's you. If you're a non-Jew, that's you, a goy. Now notice how non-assimilation is exactly the opposite of what the Jewish-dominated media in America preaches to its Gentile and mostly Christian audience.
בגלל זה אני אצלוב אותך. איך אתה מעז להטיף ליהודים התמימים?
אלוהים! למה עזבת אני?
אתה נאצי, ישו, אתה נאצי!
טופי! לא, טופי, אני מפחד! אני הלכתי על המים, אני הפכתי טופי, לא!
זה רק אפק, פחדן!
זה כואב! לא! או, טופי!
By definition, Zionism is a movement for, originally, the re-establishment and now the development and protection of a Jewish nation in what is now known as Israel. The movement originated in the eastern and central parts of Europe and became a political organization in 1897. The Zion part of Zionism refers to a hill in Jerusalem.
The first Zionist Congress was 1897.
Shortly thereafter, there was an umbrella group like the Federation of American Zionists, which had chapters, which eventually became the ZOA. They came together to form the American, this is really the AZM's origins back to 1939 in a more formal way, the American Zionist Emergency Council, to begin to push for the creation of the Jewish homeland.
I'm a Zionist, and I believe Zionism is about creating a Jewish state in the land of Israel that will be both Jewish and democratic. I believe a Jewish majority in the Jewish state is essential. And a Jewish majority means a stable Jewish majority. It doesn't mean 52% or 57%. It means 70%. And in order to do that, you can't continue to build in territory that you are going to keep and that's going to make it impossible for you to have that Jewish majority in a democratic state.
The American Zionist movement is comprised of 25 national Jewish Zionist organizations across a broad spectrum, political and Zionist and religious perspectives.
Ideologies, yes.
And ideologies. And we work together to as the American affiliate of the World Zionist Organization. So we have advocacy organizations from ZOA to AMENU, which is the old Labor Zionist Alliance, Partners for Progressive Israel, which is used to be known as Meretz USA. So we have women's organizations, Hadassah, Amit, Emuna, Namat, the old Pioneer Women. We have organizations on the religious spectrum. The Religious Zionists of America used to be known as Mizrahi, Merkaz USA, the Zionist arm of the conservative movement, Artsa, the Association of Reformed Zionists of America. We have organizations including B'nai Zion and B'nai B'rith, which are Zionist organizations and humanitarian areas and advocacy as well. We have youth movements, Habonim Dror, Hashem Eretz Yair, B'nai Akiva, USY, BBYO, NIFTY. So there's a diverse group of organizations of different types of Zionist organizations that identify as Zionist groups, and from a different religious perspective, different ideologies, and different political perspectives.
Why is it that the state of Israel is so hungry to expand territorially? Why? He has taken Ibrahim alayhi salam on a journey from Ur, which is in Babylon, which is close to the mouth of the Euphrates River, where the Euphrates River reaches the sea. And he travels with his family to the Holy Land. But notice the journey over here in what is today Iraq, and the end of the journey in what today is called Palestine. Between these two areas is a vast desert area. And so travelers would seldom, if ever, attempt to travel directly across the desert. What Ibrahim alayhi salam did, and the Jews themselves give us this information, is that he traveled northwest along the rivers where there was water until he came to the north of Syria, south of Turkey. And when he reached there, then he headed south into Palestine. In this way, he was able to skirt the desert. The Torah tells us that the Holy Land extends from the river of Egypt to the river Euphrates.
And it's time to tell the Palestinians, abandon your fantasy of destroying Israel. Abandon the fantasy that you will conquer Jerusalem.
The Iranian drone was shot down. It's got a wing here, fixed wing here.
So this was an Iranian drone sent over Golan Heights. Right. You shot it down with a F-16.
Right.
They then sent missiles and artillery to attack you on Golan Heights, and then you... Right. So this was the start of everything.
Right, that was it. That was
this
it.
Was
and
beginning.
You see it. The center was blown up by our interception.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the Joint Staff who used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got a come in, you got to come in and talk to me a second. I said, well, you're too busy. He said, no. He says, we've made the decision we're going to war with Iraq. This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, we're going to war with Iraq? Why? He said, I don't know. He said, I guess they don't know what else to do. He said, I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we got a good military and we can take down governments. And he said, I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail. And by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
My friends, the enemies of Israel are not the Boy Scouts of the world. The enemies of Israel is Iran, which is destroying its Baha'is, Sudan, which actually crucifies blacks, which is a living concentration camp for its own people, Syria, which destroyed 20,000 of its own citizens in just one fairly well-known operation a few years ago, Hamas, whose agenda is the destruction of anyone who opposes their theocracy. Those are the enemies of Israel. They are also the enemies of good people. It is not a position we Jews asked for, but when we make this known to non-Jews, they will understand why we are here.
70 years after the murder of 6 million Jews, Iran's rulers promised to destroy my country, murder my people. And the response from this body has been absolutely nothing. Utter silence. Deafening silence. Perhaps you can understand why Israel is not joining you in celebrating this deal.
Well, let's talk about Cynthia. There are many reports that talks about the influence of the Israeli lobby, AIPAC, on United States politics in general.
Well, every candidate for Congress at that time had a pledge. They were given a pledge to sign. And I was new on the scene. And so the pledge had Jerusalem as the capital city, the military superiority of Israel.
American Congress people have to sign this pledge.
Yes, you sign the pledge. If you don't sign the pledge, you don't get money. I would get a call, and the person on the other end of the phone would say, I want to do a fundraiser for you. And then we would get into the planning. I would get really excited because, of course, you have to have money in order to run a campaign. And then 2 weeks, 3 weeks into the planning, they would say, did you sign the pledge? And then I would say, no, I didn't sign the pledge. And then my fundraiser would go kaput.
Based on every statement I've heard out of any Republican in the last 2 years, the Israelis are controlling our government.
Not the State Department.
I know now what a Zionist is. I'm saddened when I hear people say they are afraid. Afraid of what? Knowing that your government has been hijacked and that those in charge will lie to you? Such knowledge should actually set us free to do what we must to maintain our own dignity. I remember what the Israeli Prime Minister said. He said, we're all Israelis now. I agree that terrorism is a problem, and I know who the terrorists are. Dick Cheney told us to expect war for the next generation and drew up a list of 60 target countries. General Wesley Clark informed us of Pentagon plans to go to war against 7 countries in 5 years: Iraq, Sudan, Somalia, Libya, Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. Syria is in process, and only Lebanon and Iran are left standing. But I'm sure their turn will come soon, too. General Wesley Clark called it a policy coup. He said that there had been a policy coup inside the United States. The U.S. media would have you believe that the U.S. is divided, non-white versus white, Christian versus Muslim. The meme of division is developed by those who write the scripts in order to pit us against each other.
Directly and indirectly, America's so-called special relationship with Israel has also generated unprecedented distrust, fear, and loathing of the United States around the world. By supporting Israel and its policies, the United States betrays not only its own national interests, but the principles it claims to embody and defend.
I'm deeply ashamed of America's leadership. I look at the politicians that are leading America now, and I believe they're completely owned by internationalists with a Zionist agenda. There's no humanitarian coming from our leadership. They have total disregard for the United States Constitution, and it's just creating tremendous hardship throughout the world now. And we need to do what we can in the immediate future to stand for our national sovereignties and the rights of the people and do everything we can to remove the power of these banker elites and their extensive networks, which do, in fact, control the American mainstream media and most of our politicians.
I want to thank you, Democrats and Republicans, for your common support for Israel year after year, decade after decade.
Democrats and Republicans are more divided today than at any other time in the last 2 decades. But America's support for Israel transcends partisan politics. For decades, AIPAC has worked to strengthen, protect, and promote the U.S.-Israel alliance by encouraging bipartisan support in Congress. Bipartisanship is more than just a nice idea. It's the most effective way to build a lasting consensus to support Israel.
Today, we finally acknowledge the obvious, that Jerusalem is Israel's capital. This is nothing more or less than a recognition of reality.
America's commitment to the security of Israel is ironclad, and I might add, so is mine.
Like all Americans, I have been inspired by Israel's long struggle to survive and to flourish. America, as always, is proud to stand with you.
And you have built a mighty democracy that will endure forever and can always count on the United States of America to be at your side.
And as the president of a country that you can count on as your greatest friend, I believe your future is bound to ours.
The respect and the admiration we have for the people of this nation, their courage, their tenacity, is one that makes us proud to stand with Israel as we have in the past.
It was 70 years ago that the United States under President Truman recognized the State of Israel. I stand in awe of the accomplishments of the Jewish people, and I make this promise to you: my administration will always stand with Israel.
Israel is grateful for the support of America's people and of America's presidents. We share a common destiny, the destiny of promised lands that cherish freedom and offer hope. Even if Israel has to stand alone, Israel will stand. I know that America stands with Israel. I know that you stand with Israel. God bless the United States of America.
country there is problem, and that problem is the truth. They take everybody money, they never give it back. Throw the Jew down the well, so my country can be free. You must grab him by his horns, then we have a big party. If you see the Jew coming, you must be careful of his teeth. You must grab him by his money, and I tell you what to do. Everybody, throw the Jew down the well, so my country can be free. You must grab him by his horns, then we have a big party. Throw the Jew down the well, so my country can be free.
Ha 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 ha!